This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Breaking Ground, a podcast about earth-moving machinery and characters in the industry. Both your hosts work for Terra Cat, New Zealand's Caterpillar machinery dealer. I'm Marty Turrett.
And I'm Richard Clark. In this podcast, we hear stories from a wide range of people in our industry, and today we're pleased to introduce Tony Brand. Tony is the Director of Brand Logging based in Rangura, with crews working throughout the Canterbury region. Brand Logging's been operating since 1984, when Tony and his wife Karen started the business. Tony is our first forestry contractor to be on Breaking Ground, and it's great to have him in the studio. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks. Good to be along.
Now, 38 years in forestry is a long time to be in the industry, but your family initially had a farming background. Take us back to your early years and from there where your interest in the bush came from.
Oh, so Dad, he worked on a farm in Waiau, actually, and then he got a job up in Nelson. He was working for a construction company up there, driving a dozer. And then he ended up working for Bajants there and, just doing the tracking for the loggers and putting the roads in for the trucks and that. And as a kid, I used to just love going out there, go to work with them on Saturday, any chance I get, I'll be out there. And I just love being around those skidders and chainsaws. And in them days, kids could just wander around, you could do what you like, pretend you're chasing a pig or whatever. I just loved it. So it got me interested in it back then.
So tell us about the early days when you actually started logging yourself.
I was working on a rural transport at the time, and we got sold to another rural transport, and the old man had a skidder. Him and my brother were doing a bit of earth moving, and they had this old skidder and they had a wee contract, and they wanted to sell it. So me and my mate, I says, oh, over a couple of beers, says, that'd be a good idea. We'll buy that. So we bought it. It was 12 grand. I think we paid for it was an old Timberjack 205. Got a couple of chainsaws, 051, and put them on McCulloch and a couple of Dolmars that you want to kick every time you tried to start them. And we had a contract for 20 ton a day with the local mill, and we just did it on the weekends. So we still carried on working and just ticked away with that. And yeah, on a Saturday we'd go and cut our 20 ton a few beers. We didn't know much. We just liked it. We just liked the idea of it. And we were in partnership for that first year, me and Stu.
Oh, often the best ideas are often formed up over a beer, so it's obviously worked out well.
Yeah, no, it was good. And we left our jobs eventually. One of my mates had a farm up the top of the Rakaia Gorge, which I'd worked up there for their old man as a shepherd. And they had all these trees. And back then it was really quite tricky to get into logging. And my mates had these trees. And they said to McVickers, well, if you want the trees, these guys are logging it. And they're like, who the hell are they? And we were a bit like that. We were no one. And we jacked our jobs in and went big time loggers. We had a 3-month contract. We're into it.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's sort of quite impressive where you sort of, obviously now Brand Logging's a really well-established Canterbury logging business, and sort of to hear come from that where it's sort of working on a Saturday through to where you are now. So I suppose for that, tell us about your operations to where and what it looks like today when we sort of think back to obviously working on a Saturday only to what have you got now?
So we run the... We've got 4 logging crews running around mostly north or the Canterbury region in general, and we've got our workshop, the old forestry workshop that we bought 11 years ago that was got about 12 guys up there, and we've got the Husqvarna dealership in Rangura as well. We've only had that for a couple of 3 years. But on the logging side, we've got 2 crews work for Matariki, Rainier, one fully met. Dead flat operation, doing about 450 ton a day, harvesters, four, couple of harvesters, couple of forwarders, and a loadout machine. And we've got another one works for them in the hills doing a bit of tether on that with Foothills Wood. And we have two private crews we run that work for Lawrie Forestry around here, and similar sort of just working in the foothills or wherever we can in the winter, and tether operations when needed as well. We've got three tether machines. We've got two at the moment. We've got one just getting built at the moment, so we have another one of those up and running, the DC one. So we're fairly sorted. We've got about 22 staff in their logging operations, and run a bit of roading in amongst that, and run one log truck.
Well, so it's more than just sort of where we think of just logging itself. It's all the support side that you guys have obviously integrated well into now as well, with workshops and also sort of roading and things like that too.
There's a bit going on.
Yeah.
Like getting the tiger by the tail sometimes, like, geez, what are we doing? But, hey, keeps you thinking.
That's the one.
Keeps you going. And, yeah, no, it's quite, that's quite good.
So, you know, when we sort of think about logging, it generally takes place in pretty rough and rugged environments. Does it take a certain type of person to work in forestry contracting as far as your sort of history goes and the people you've had along the journey?
I think loggers are different. We're different, and I reckon we're bloody eternal optimists. Well, I know I am. You always look at a block. Whatever you think you're going to pull, that's your best day. So that's you're stuffed there, because you forget about the rain and the breakdowns, and you work out, oh, you know, we should be right. If we don't break anything there, everyone's at work, which we do. We're pretty good with that side of it. But yeah, I think you've got to be a blooming optimist. You've got to have a real good tolerance for debt these days. Back in the early days when all we had was a 666 and a few guys, we had everything paid off. We didn't even have a mortgage on our house. Well, that's all out the window now. But yeah, so no, it's, I think it's just like everyone in business got different challenges as a, yeah, I don't know, things can go bad in the dollar department.
Because it can be pretty cyclical from, I suppose, a log price export as well, and that has, I suppose, some uncertainty from year to year, doesn't it, with you?
Yeah, you get used to that. That's just like, I've just seen so many ups and downs. Like anyone who's been as long as me would just be like, oh, yeah, whatever. I don't get too hung up on it. And interest rates, it's like, oh, yeah. When we started, it was like, 26 or 27%. So it's like anything under 10, I'm like, oh, we're quids in.
So other than sort of the financial challenges and stuff like that you sort of touched on, what are some of the other challenges over the years that you've sort of seen working around an environment like that?
It's an interesting one, because I think about that. I don't look back very much.
Yep.
It's quite tricky because there's usually something going on the front that you're like, geez, how are we going to sort that out? So you don't, I think you just go through all that and
put it in the past and
yeah, move on. Like, you know, it used to be getting jobs, but that was great because it was a challenge that you actually liked. I was like, oh, I got that one.
Yep.
And yeah, and it just markets, once I worried about those, I don't know when that was, a long time ago. But yeah, no, yeah, I think the trouble is you don't focus on the past, just get on.
And I suppose if you, with that sort of mindset, it's a really good way to look forward to the future and be excited about the future and stuff like that as well. So it's sort of, it's a good mentality to have by the sounds of it, and obviously a very successful one too. So while there's sort of challenges and stuff like that, obviously there's great rewards as well. So you've sort of 38 years that you've been doing. Can you tell us about some of the rewards or some of the rewarding things that you've noticed along that time?
A lot to do with people I've met, like that I never would have known. Like, no matter what they are, whether they're the forest company people, the truckies, mechanics, our suppliers, people who've worked for us. Just there's heaps of people I've met on the trips and what have you. It's been great. The industry's given us a good living. Like, I don't know what I would have done. I left school and buddy, I was 15, so I was probably heading down the road of doing something different. And Yeah, I'd go down the same track again. If I had my time again, I'd be doing the same. There's nothing, hopefully a few less cock-ups would be good.
But that what sort of makes it as well. you don't get an easy way through and get to sort of success and stuff without a few learning curves along the way.
But builds character.
That's the one.
Which is sometimes a bit of a pain if that's what it takes. But I reckon one of the things we're experts on is I've got really good at is getting machines unstuck over the years. Most loggers are real good at that. And got a lot of good skills that a lot of people don't get to do.
And probably some good holes that they came out of as well.
Oh, yeah, a few cover-ups.
Now, Tony, you talked about before loggers are probably a bit different, but what's a commonly held belief about loggers in the industry that you'd probably disagree with? There's probably maybe a perception out there from the general public, but if there was something that you sort of thought yourself that that's not true?
It's probably more like the common thing, as you guys will know, is that it's dangerous and environmentally we bloody make a mess because we start with this beautiful forest and I go to those roading, I've been to those roading award things and over the years with the Kennery Contract Association, whatever it is, and they have these pristine jobs, they get all these awards for it. I was like, geez, when we start, this is a beautiful forest. When we finish, it's like, oh, it looks like you've dropped a bomb on it. And I think that's what people think. They don't realise that we're doing it to an environmental standard. When we do that, we've got to do things about controlling the water. And we're just getting ready to replant. It's just a farm. It's just that we do it all in 5 minutes. And it's been growing away and looks lovely. And everyone uses a bit of wood. But they forget there's probably no one in the world who doesn't use a bit of wood for something, and it's a wipe their bum. So, yeah, it's like that, and the health and safety, because if something goes wrong, it's in the news, and it's not like any other job where and we could be in here, I could trip over, and I go, oh, might be get a knock on my knee or something. You do that in the bush, and you get a stick through your leg or something. So, you just got to be careful in our job, and we've got things in place to keep people safe, but unfortunately you still get a few things that go wrong and it's just more major.
Yes, it's good to hear, and I think good for the general public to understand that a bit more, and you explaining that in those terms I think helps to just put it in a perspective, definitely. And also I suppose from your perspective in forestry, you've been working for many years now, is there a model or a piece of equipment that sort of sits close to your heart?
Probably my old Clark, which I'm doing up at the moment, the old 666 C that we're restoring, and the old Bell Ultra Logger. So those two machines got us going, got us really into it. So yeah, but the 666, there's a lot of years before they made a machine that would equal that. There'd be a few people out there think I'm talking rubbish. I don't care, they can't answer me, can they?
But not here, they can't.
No. But power to weight, get 140 horsepower machine that only weighs about 7 ton. It took a lot of years before they could make something that would equal that.
And so have you retained that 666? I know you mentioned it from very early on. Have you kept that within the company all that time till now you're doing it up, or is it?
I bought it in 1987, so it was my newest acquisition at the time, and it was a second-hand machine. A guy, Kevin Graham and Nelson had had it, and we ran it for a few years, and then we got the Catholt contract in 91, and we were running two crews, and so I sold it off to one of my guys who worked for me, guy Phil Russell, in 92, and he took over the crew. He used for a few years, and then he just sat in his paddock rusting away, and 2016, I bought it back off Phil, and we took it back to the workshop, got my guys every spare minute to get into it, and just ripped it. We just got out of control. We literally got out of control. We ripped it, everything out. It was just a whole lot of stuff on the ground, transmission, engine, diffs. There's nothing left. Took it down, straightened it all out. And 6 years on, a whole lot of stuff, and basically myself and my son-in-law Craig have been putting it back together. We wanted to put it together. We didn't want to pay someone to put it together, so that's taken us a while. But yeah, she's looking good. And we're hoping to get it up to the forestry show at Rotorua in November.
So you've got a deadline now.
It's pretty close. I was going back to the painters this week to get all the bolts painted, and Signwriter was out last week and just sent me all the stuff for it. So there might be the odd guy who knows a bit about them might pick something up. But I think we've got it pretty good.
And what are the plans for that? You've got the forestry show in November in Rotorua, but where will that sit? What will you do with it from there?
I don't know. That's everyone asked me. My wife, she's like, what's it going to do? And I said, I'm just going to look at it, have a beer and look at it. Start up every night and have a listen to that Detroit. Or any old loggers come around, they'll be like, start her up. And we'll get on to the next one. We've got a 668 sitting there ready to go into the workshop. So hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this.
Now, Tony, the forestry industry has evolved a lot since you started, and in particular over the last 20 years. From your perspective, what do you see as the key changes that you've seen over that time?
For us, it was probably that move into mechanisation, and like we bought a bale in 1990, so before that we didn't do any fleeting. We just pulled everything with a skidder, cut everything up by hand and send the old hire truck in there and tell him to help himself. And we started having to sort logs, so we bought the bow. 92, the static dilemma came out. We bought, it was like the two come into the South Island, we bought one of them, and that was awesome. Got rid of all that hard trimming and hand trimming. 94, we bought our first harvester off Cat, Cat 320 with a Waratah shear head on it for doing chip. 95 first gravel skidder, so that sort of changed things for us. We bought one of the first 525s. Then Carter's got into the key supplier stuff and caused a bit of a panic buying of bits and pieces. We got that in Canterbury, and we started our first cut to length operation, which harvester, forwarder, loader type setup. We did that for a while, and then the guy that was running the circus then, he didn't like it, and we had to go back to manual cutting up, and that was a bit annoying. And then by 2005, I think we were back into full mechanisation again, so we had a bit of a stint away. But so after we got to full mech with like fella bunches and on the hill and harvesters on the skid, we didn't do a lot until probably the tether stuff's come in for us in the last 5, 6, 7 years. Time does get away.
Mm.
And other than that, it's just smaller changes, just tweaking environmental, health and safety. Things that you're just doing little bits. And because you imagine when we started, there was no such thing as hard hats. You wouldn't have a seatbelt. Chaps was hard dragging us into the, make us wear chaps and things like that. These are all things that you just take for granted now. And we thought we'd been real environmentally friendly when we found an old Winthrow stump hole and dropped the oil out of the engine into that, and we're changing the oil, and a creek you'd pull down. Well, that's good. It's going to keep logs all nice and clean. There won't be too much dirt in them. Wouldn't go near a creek these days. Didn't do cutouts to direct the water or, just do tracks wherever you want. And but these days that's changed a lot, and it's all about water, which it's good. You can see why too.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of changes, that's for sure. And obviously most of them for the good, for the better.
So. Yeah, and just that tons per man, like back, like in the old days, everyone sort of worked on that load a day per man. And these days we're somewhere between 70 and 90 ton a day per man. So it's huge production increase over what we used to do.
Mm.
And I think as well that one of the biggest surprises that I had when I got into industry or sort of went out to my first forestry sites and that sort of thing was just the professionalism of a site now. It is a business. It is essentially what we see as if you were to walk into a business on the street, you see that it's on a skid site, for example. So it's the same sort of things that you go in where there's sort of health and safety reps or there's, emergency procedures. Everything that you'd normally see is on a forestry site now, whereas there's sort of originally I had this conception that it was sort of pretty rough and rugged and that sort of thing, but they're very sort of professional sites and that sort of thing now that you go out to.
Yeah, and you'd find that, you know, we're probably, because we're so into it, and we have been for so many years, sometimes you don't think about it because we're doing it, but when I go to other businesses, I notice that a lot of these is just, oh, yeah, you just sign that bit of paper. But with us, it's, if someone's on your site, man, you're making sure they're not going anywhere they're not supposed to go, and really keeping an eye on them, and, you know, morning meetings every day with the crews. It's not something you talk about. It's actually done, and it's written down, and it comes through to our office at the end of the week. And
have you found that, obviously, you talk about production gains, but also the health and safety side, one of the biggest things that we've sort of noticed is actually the two go hand in hand. You have a morning meeting to discuss sort of their sort of put in for health and safety side of things, but have you noticed that's where it's really key piece in helping production in that too?
Definitely helps, and the guys all just, everyone knows what they're up to, and because it can change from day to day with the weather, and might even be what we need to cut, or sometimes the guys go, oh, we've got nothing to talk about, but there is always, there's just always something. It could be like, yeah, the smoker, where are we stopping? What's the story? We need to go a bit later today. We've got visitors later on or something. But, yeah, it is very professional.
Yeah, certainly a good process to get into and have from a business perspective. And it's great to see. So away from forestry, Tony, you talked about the rebuilding of the old Clark, but I know that you've got a passion for motorsport and you are a Holden man. Where does that interest come from?
I've always liked racing, like just, you know, as a kid, like I remember the old man used to take us to Lady Wigram here in Christchurch, and when that was still around, and you go there and then you go to the stock cars every now and then. It was a real treat if you actually got to go something like that. It was more when we went to Nelson. And, yeah, as the time went on, I just got into it. As far as the Holdens go, I've always had Holdens, HR, HQs, HQ work utes and cars and heaps of Commodores, GTS, Club Sports and that. I only had two Fords. One was a Mark IV Zephyr. Which any other old codgers out there like me will be like, geez, those things weren't very reliable. But you could take a lot of people in it. And the Sheilas didn't mind it either. And I think the missus had a Ford Laser there at one stage, and that was pretty crap.
So, I was going to say, that probably didn't stick around too long.
Nah, so that was her car. It went all right, but it was, yeah, it was a Ford. So, yeah, I'm just a Holden man. So, yeah, and I went a few years ago, I was lucky enough. Goffs, I'll struggle with the Terra, but the Goffs took me to, they had this, oh, it was American Chamber of Commerce thing they used to take you to, and someone would talk. And when we went to leave, the guy that was taking, he goes, oh, if you look under your seat, there might be something there for you, a prize. And I was like, oh, yeah. And, yeah, I looked under my seat and there's this thing. It's like, oh, well, I've won this package to go to the Wellington Street Race, and I've got a hot lap with Neil Crompton, who's now a commentator for the thing and for the racing. And it was quite funny because Ross Francis had been sitting on that seat, and when I come in, he moved around for me to sit on it. he was dark. I says, you did move. And so I went up there and I got that hot lap with him, and I was like, geez, scared the living daylights out of me.
Yeah.
But I thought, this is pretty cool. And then I probably got more into the V8s watching it, and yeah, since then, been to a few, Bathurst, and been to Formula One a couple of times, and yeah.
Any highlights from those trips in terms of Bathurst and Formula One? Was there anything that sort of stood out?
Bathurst was pretty funny. Terry Locke was running the thing, and he's a dead set Ford idiot. And we're driving down the road in the old van. We're in the Toyota, so I don't know what he's worried about, but he's pretty funny, old Terry. And this guy was coming up beside us in this ute, and old Terry just cuts him off. Like, we're on the main road, just cuts him off big time. And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm not letting no Holden pass me. And eventually, this guy managed to get past us, and it was a bloody Ford. It was a flat deck one tonner. That was funny, but old Terry, he's like, I like that passion. I think it's good when someone's really into it. Any motorbike tried to pass us on the inside, they weren't allowed to pass. And then, yeah, at the track, it was awesome. We got to go down on the track, and we were in the cat tent on the end of Conrad, and me and it was Simon and Adam, my two boys, come with me, and we were the only ones, that 200 people at Tentel, were the only ones that had a Holden shirt on, because they had old, what's his name, was driving the cat car. Was that Jason Bright?
Oh, yeah, Jason Bright, yes. Yeah, he was part of the cat racing team at one stage.
Yeah, and the Aussies like, you're pretty cheeky coming in here with a Holden top on. And we're like, oh, whatever.
So who had the last laugh that day?
Now, that was the day, geez, you put me on the spot there. That was the day Murphy and Ambrose had a big ding up the top of the hill, and they got out and they were going to have a, it looked like they might have had a wee handbag. A wee handbag. I can't remember. I'd say it would have been Holden.
Yeah. I'm sure Cherry Light probably thought it was going to be Ford. Now, continuing on that motorsport theme, you've actually competed in truck racing yourself. How did that start, and how enjoyable has that been?
So my brother, he worked for a contractor down in Ashburton, and he was into the truck racing, but we were going there for Christmas dinner a few years ago. It's about 10 years ago now. And me bro, he's like, oh, when you come down, make sure you bring your checkbook. I've got something you'll want to buy. You won't be able to go home without it. I said, all right, so I went down there. And turned out that Brent Jones wanted to sell that truck. He'd bought a new one, and it was a KM Bedford. And I thought, that'll look cool in my yard. I was just going to buy it and keep it. But old Brent, he said, I'll sell it to you. But he made me shake his hand and say that we'd race it for 1 year, one season, and I had to drive it. Because he thought if I didn't drive it, I'd probably get sick of spending money and get no fun out of it. So it was a good idea. So I drove it, and it was pretty gutless, and I didn't know much, and yeah, do those reverse grids. I'd never driven on a racetrack in my life, and I've done a couple of days with different companies going out there, scooting around. But so it was interesting, and so we did that season at the back of the field the whole time, and I thought, well, that's not much good. So we came out of the season, and I'd had to get a job done on one of the machine by Goff Engineering. They were supposed to be guarding up a machine of ours in Rotorua, and they dicked us around, and they hadn't, we thought they'd started it like 3 months before, and they hadn't. We found out they hadn't, and I got real snarly with Goffs at the time, and I wasn't talking to them. I got in a grump, and they kept saying, oh, can we do this? Nah, not doing anything. Nah, just nothing. Nothing's going to fix it. Nothing. And then Dean Heaney comes along one day, and he goes, I've been thinking about it. And he says, what if we did some work on your racetrack and made it real good for you? And I was like, oh, you buggers.
That'll work.
So we went down to, me and him went down to Cromwell and had a look at Inky Tullock's truck, because that was the most successful truck that had ever been in truck racing up to that stage, and between New Zealand and Australia. And we were there at opening, and we had that thing, bloody everything open, and we were measuring, and we basically come back. Dean went to Goff Engineering and says, you're making that. On the chassis side of it, all the brakes and the chassis, and we sent the engine off to Trans Diesel, and they also, we needed heap of horsepower, got that, and come back, and yeah, she was real good. It basically just put us back to in the pack. No horsepower, still only at 800 horse versus 12, 14, 16, 18, 2,000 horsepower. But hey, we still have a lot of fun.
So what was that like? I mean, you talked about doing that hot lap in Wellington all those years ago and frightened the bejesus out of you, but what about when you're actually racing those trucks? Because they're pretty impressive when they are side by side, you know, going down the back straight at however fast they're going. What's that like?
Well, the funny thing, so that first meeting I went to at Ruapuna, the boys were going to, they went there, I had no mechanics, so I knew nothing. They'd gone to a show in Oz, some country show over there, and I turned up. And I'd done my drive. I'd had to get the race license, and you read all the thing in the race license. It says, for three meetings, you've got to start at the back of the field, was like, oh, that's good. That should be all right. Just chug around behind everyone. So I did one race. You do your qualifying, then you do your race. Qualified last. It was good. I'm following everyone around. I was like, I can get the hang of this. And bugger me, they pull the draw for the next race. And oh, Christine, the Sheila that runs here, I think she comes on. She goes, oh, yeah, you're off one. And I was like, there's one in the back. And no, one's the front. I was like, no, you got that wrong. Well, I've got to go off the back. I've got to do it for 3 meetings. She goes, yeah, this is big boys racing. She says, the crowd don't come to watch people follow each other. They come to watch someone bash their way through and get to the front. I was like, oh, my God. So, yeah, that was it. So it was bloody reverse grids. There was no – the rules don't apply in truck racing. And it's like, oh, I won't hit you if you get out of, if you're not in my road. I'm like, well, I'm always going to be in your road because I'm actually going to be in front of you on a reverse grid. So, yeah, we did get a few things. But, hey, I was learning too, and it was good. And you go down there, you forget about when you're racing. You don't – you're a bit nervy at the start. Sometimes you're like, you just need all those big boys to get past you. But now I don't want them to pass me. I'm sort of hoping to do as much as I can to stop them. I get the odd push from time to time.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine. So you sort of mentioned going to Bathurst and things like that. Also, you've travelled around quite a bit, or quite extensively, especially internationally in that as well. So what are some of the awesome places around the world that you've visited as far as a logging sort of operation goes, or an industry side of things goes? And tell us about some of the more interesting ones that you've sort of seen and been to.
Done a few. Been real lucky, and it's the most I've been with Kat. And my first one was Japan in 99. I bought a couple of 322Bs. I've still got one of those, actually. That's still that one of those machines from then. And we still use it a bit. And we went to Japan. So I had only ever been to Australia maybe twice before that. That was my big overseas trips. And yeah, went to bloody Japan. It was great. Like, we had a great time travelling around, and they liked their beer. And we went to the factories. There was a lot of beer drunk, and got to go on the bullet train. And yeah, that was a great trip. And there was industry people. There was a couple of 3 loggers on that trip, and about 12 of us, I think. But yeah, no, that was great. Done a couple of Con Expos. They're awesome. Going over there.
Into Vegas, yes.
Yeah, into Vegas. And the first one we went to, I remember there was myself and my wife, Kieran, Malcolm, and Angie Edridge, and we were just sort of hanging around together. And we went into this big building, and we're like, Jesus, there's a lot of stuff in here. And we spent about 3 hours in there, in this building. And then we were talking to some guy, so which way's out? And they said, where are you going? And we're done, we'll just have a bit of the outside stuff. No, this is only this is like the little toilet block. And it's massive. Anyone who's listening who's been there will know. And then, of course, you go to Bauma, and Bauma's like double or triple the size. So, yeah, it was good. That was a good trip to see. But we've done Pacific Northwest. I went on a trip over there, and we landed in Seattle. That was all loggers, so it was pretty agricultural. And we just got in we had 3 vehicles, and we just, I think Wayne Baker was in charge of that one. And we travelled down, visited a heap of loggers. And we had this guy, this logger we visited. And over here we have this, when we cut down a tree, the idea is you've got to get it as low as you can, because all the value of your tree is in the bottom is your big diameter. You need to get it low. And these bloody stumps, we were talking about it, and they'd cut these stumps. You could just get over them with a 5, 6, 8, some of them. And that's a high and wide machine. Like, they're massive. A lot of them they wouldn't have got over. And so we'd have a talk about it. And the guy was talking to us, he had his back to these trees and the stumps and that. And he says, have you got any questions? And I says, is there a reason you cut those stumps so high? And he got a bit, he didn't like it. And he looked around and he goes, what are you talking about? What high stumps? And we're like, yeah. It was hilarious, because some of them would be like 4 foot high. But these are the characters. They do things a bit different, and they don't have a lot of health and safety over there. There's not like it is here. And yeah, we visited the the Brownings off the X-Men show, if anyone's ever watched that on telly.
Yes,
and that X-Men show, I don't recommend it to anyone, either people who are not loggers, to watch that, to think that's what the logging industry's like, because it's real bad, the program. But those guys were actually quite good loggers, and they were good guys, but they just have so many cameras looking at their job, and they're just looking for drama.
Yes.
But no, they were good. They took us out. We had a few beers with them, and they were good fellas. We did a trip down through Georgia. That was interesting. North Carolina, another trip. Dean Heaney, Dean Brown, and James Lundy in the car. In cars again. They were real good trips. So you don't forget anything you have to get on a bus with is the go for me. I'm in the car, it's great. You can stop and buddy, have a leak or a beer or whatever you want along the way. And there's a bit of only story about that one. We went out one morning. We had to leave at about like 4 a.m. to catch a plane. That was your offside, of course. Was that Sheila who used to sort her flights out? The young girl?
Oh, I'm trying to think.
She worked.
Put me on the spot.
She worked with you. Good. On the spot. So she had us going real early, and we're sitting down in the thing we're waiting for. I think Nick Tomlinson slept in. I'm not getting at you, Nick, if you ever listen to this, because I've done it myself. And waiting for him down in the thing, and this girl comes down. She'd gone out for something, and she'd locked herself out, and she's in the old nud. And she just wandered down into the lobby, and we're all just sitting there, and she would have expected to see no one. She was panic stations. And someone found her someone found her a coat or something, good with that. But that wasn't the funny bit of the story. It probably wasn't funny for her, but we went out to go, and we're on a real tight schedule, and we go out there, and one of the cars is already running. It's already going. So one of the logging guys had taken it for a drive the day before and parked it up and hadn't taken the keys. And it was one of those ones that, you know, they turn themselves off.
Oh, yes, yes.
I think he might have taken the keys, but it started itself up again for some reason because he hadn't turned it off. And so it was out of petrol. And she was panicked. So those guys, it was great. They were old Dean Brown, I think he was really panic station. We had to get there, find a petrol station. It just had enough. It was the fuel light was on. And yeah, that was a good entertainment on that one. Done a fair few trips, and there's a lot of things you can't talk about, obviously, obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, I suppose talking on the back of some of those trips, potentially, there would have been a lot of interesting characters that you've come across in all your years in logging. Do one or two legends sort of stand out that you'd like to tell a story about?
There's a lot that likes to work for you guys more. Like, I know a lot of loggers. Well, I don't know if I can think of anything I want to say that I'm put on the...
You've probably got to catch up with them at some stage soon.
I can put on the wireless, but... with goths, I've found they always employed... The guys I seem to deal with were entertaining people. Like, probably a bit like... They seem to be a bit like us.
Yes.
And anything for a good time. And things I'll just... Guys like Dave Falvey, he's a bit of a character. Winston Muldrew was my sales guy back in the early days, and he was putting the smoke like a bloody train. And every time we went anywhere, he'd have to, I just got to shoot out for a smoke, mate. He's dead now. I think the smoker might have got to him, but he used to get real nervous flying, and he'd be sitting outside in the wind at Wellington having a smoke while we were waiting to get on. I never seen him when we used to travel. He was always outside smoking. And, of course, Lockie. Templer, you've had him on here, Steve Templer.
Yes, yeah, he was our first podcast.
There's been a lot in those guys, and they sort of relate to people like yourselves. And they took me to the rugby when we bought our first cat, and I had a Hitachi. I got a price on a Hitachi for my harvester, and it was a big deal for us because we'd paid, our house cost us, I think, it was about $65,000. Brand new house, built it myself, still standing, by the way, so, which is quite good. And even though I only got 28 in woodwork, so it wasn't too bad. I think all the locals thought it was going to fall down. But, yeah, so that time that sort of house was worth, and that harvester cost us $405,000 to buy. So that was a big deal when we were buying that. And so we need to get this, like, the cheapest machine. And the Cat 320 was about 20 grand dearer than a Hitachi 20-ton or whatever the model was, something too, I don't know what they were. But anyhow, I was going to buy the Hitachi because I was just buying the cheapest machine. I need to get something and thought they might be all right. And, someone rang me out. So, do you want to get the rig? I think it might have been old Dave Felvey. He's like, do you want to get the rig? We've got a ticket. I was like, well, I've never been on the bank for the rugby.
Well, this is back in the Lancaster Park days.
We went. There's a lot of drinking. I'm not 100% sure. It was definitely Lancaster Park. Yeah, so I'd only ever been on the bank. And so we're in this box or something. I can't remember. But the whole thing was pretty hazy. Had a great night. And the guy, and I thought, geez, these are good guys. Well, those sort of guys I'd work with. And so long story short, it was a Lions match. I guessed the score, 24-18, and won the rugby ball. I got signed rugby ball. It's still up in my shed somewhere. But, yeah, long story short, I rang old Andrew McCoy from Cables. He's still the salesman there.
He is.
And says, yeah, sorry, I'm going to buy that cat. I think I might have agreed to it that night or something. But those guys are all good. And anyone who knows those guys know that they're quite entertaining people in their different ways to be around.
And you sort of say, you know, so those guys and also with sort of loggers and that in general. So you must have a really good team around you, and you sort of said how you've got quite a substantial team of guys around you. So with being around and brand logging being around sort of 1984 sort of timeline. So what are some of the secrets to building and retaining such a good team? And obviously that helps in longevity of a business and things like that. What's some of the secrets that you've got?
Don't know if there's any secrets, but... Yeah, I think sometimes look at that. We've got a lot of guys who work for us for a long time, and they're good people. So we employ people who we think are good people, and so that helps. So they tend to work good. You treat them good, and we provide steady work, good conditions. We don't lay people off. Like, it was a downturn. We've had all these things over the years. We just keep people, and I say with eternal optimists, we're like, oh, it'll come right. And the last thing you want to do is get rid of skilled people. And I think just treat them all right. And we know that you're nothing without your staff. Like, you can have all the fancy gear and no matter what. And you'll find most people that do all right, they've just got good staff. Us as managers are just trying to hold it all together up top, and the guys down there are doing the job for us.
And that's probably one of the things that we've heard from a lot of people now is, also good people attract and help retain good people and that sort of thing. So it sort of creates a culture in that too.
Yeah, it's good. We don't get the pub like we used to, which is a bit of a bugger, but we used to be able to do that. But the old cops have sorted that out. They're too scared to have a beer these days. How can you just have one?
Sometimes you're allowed to have two, but
you've got to be careful.
Know what you're saying there. So
they were great team builders. Especially when you have one on the job before you left, and just a couple of stubbies or a couple of big bottles, whatever it was, and head off home. But it's not the same once you get out the gate. But
Now you were sort of talking before about being, I suppose, an eternal optimist. But there are challenges in the industry out there at the moment. What do you think the biggest challenge from a forestry perspective at present is? And, how do you think that might be overcome?
It's probably rising costs, but I was thinking about that. And basically, I think if you're in business, that's everyone. So you just got to adapt and just get used to anything that comes your way and just get on with it, really. And always try to be more productive. That's, as a logger, that's what you've got to do with the, we're not on by the hour, we're on by the ton. So you've just got to try and think how you can get a little bit more. You look how far we've come. We were doing 25 tonne a day per man. Now we're doing between 75 and 90. And maybe you've got to get just figure out how you get that next bit and keep the costs under control so you're not, yeah, you've got something left.
And I suppose to finish up, Tony, personally for you, what do you think, you know, the next part of your life sort of holds for you with brand logging, and maybe something away from the industry? Where do you sort of see yourself in the future?
I'll just keep ticking along. I'm 63, so I'll just keep ticking along for a bit. My son Simon, he manages a logging business now, and him and his wife have bought into the business as well. And we're in the process of going through that with the other two kids, and Adam, one of our boys, runs one of the crews. Daughter, son-in-law work for us, and Karen's still in the office. She's ready to knock off, but just get the business set up for the next generation. I want to finish the Forestry Museum I've been talking about doing. Hopefully get that done, and maybe just hang around yarn and old loggers that turn up, buddy, for something to do. They have a fridge there, but they'll definitely have a beer there. I'm supposed to be on 4-day week, so I'll try to get into three, and basically when the Balmoral Forest is finished, that was going to be my end time, which I've been working in Earwall and Balmoral Forest since I started logging, so we did it way back in cutting and carrying posts in bloody 1984. We went to Earwall for the first time, so it's all going back into farm, so do a bit of travel, throw that in, because Kieran, when she wants to go travelling, I want to go travelling.
And I'm sure there'll be some racing in there as well.
Yeah, and I still like being involved in the industry, so I don't want to step out because then I'm going to lose all that day-to-day contact with everyone. So that's the thing. It's like, I'm not sick of people. A lot of people say they're sick of people. I'm not. I like people.
Mm. Nice. Well, thank you very much, Tony, for coming on Breaking Ground today. It's been really good chatting with you, and there's a few definitely a few good yarns that have popped into there and that sort of thing. So thank you very much to our listeners as well. We hope you enjoyed the conversation, and thank you very much, Tony.
Thanks, it was good.
And for our listeners, we'd love your feedback, so get in touch with us. You can send us a message on any of our TerraCat social media channels, and keep an eye on our TerraCat Facebook page for the details about next month's episode of Breaking Ground. Thanks a lot and goodbye.
Bye.